From the deranged mind of a madman with a microphone, it's a drinking podcast with a movie problem. You're listening to Not Suitable for Anyone.
Movie that I want to talk about, and so I invite somebody that was, you know, sort of involved in, you know, making that movie, and you know, we talk through it.
Okay.
And I, you know, I specialize in, you know, sort of lower budget features, you know, micro budget movies, what, you know, crowdfunded, self-funded.
Oh, I like that.
You know, like real, like homemade type projects are really like kind of my go-tos. I've done some.
That's great. What's the name of the podcast again? I'm sorry, I didn't do my research. I have such a busy week.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, it's called Not Suitable for Anyone.
Okay, I'll have to do some promotion for that. That's cool.
So yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and I heard about you by way of Sophia Cassiola.
Oh yeah, yeah. I know Sophia and Michael real well.
Yeah, I talked to her about Clickbait.
Oh yeah, good movie.
And yeah, I love that movie. And so, you know, we started like following each other on social media and that kind of thing. And I saw that she had mentioned Micro Budget Marauders 2.
Oh yeah.
So I watched that and I started to kind of find out more about you. And I was like, this is a guy I've got to talk to. Because like you're like a movie making machine.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of a little industry unto myself.
So yeah. So I just kinda wanted to, you know, just sort of have kind of a more casual conversation about about what you do and sort of your various projects. Cause like for people that are that are gonna listen, I mean I'm not joking. I mean you got started around 2005 or so.
Yeah, my first movie was released in 2005. We shot it in 2003.
Okay. All right. And then since then, you've got like 50 producer credits.
Yeah.
And 20, yeah, over 20 directorial credits. So.
Right. And I use pseudonyms a lot on stuff too. Like, especially on, we can get into it later, but on documentaries, I like to make my name more as a producer as opposed to a director. So like I either use a pseudonym or I give it away to another crew position.
Oh, okay. All right, that's interesting. So you've actually directed, I guess, more than what's sort of in your IMDb.
Oh yeah, definitely. I would say probably 80% of the documentaries that are on there that are listed to somebody else are directed by me.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Yeah. You're like Captain America. You know, where you just keep lapping all the other guys while they're making, you know, one film every 3 years.
Right. I mean, there's a few. I mean, do you know a guy named Dustin Ferguson?
No.
He's a horror filmmaker, and I think he has like 110 directing credits now. Like this last year, he directed like 16 features, narrative features.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You should, if you do micro budget stuff, you should check the guy out. He puts out a lot of content.
Yeah, and definitely check that out. There was another guy, Bresic, James Cullen Bresic.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah. I know the name. I don't know him personally, but
yeah. So yeah, and so, but in addition to that, like you've got a lot of other stuff going on. You've got your own podcast and, you know, your YouTube channel, where you talk really openly about the business of filmmaking, and mm-hmm. you know, that's not something that you see a lot of filmmakers talk about for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think it's kind of an older mentality. You know, like, cause you know, when I was growing up, you know, I'm in my 40s now, and it was, you know, it was always taught to me that it was, you know, inappropriate to talk money, like how much you make or how much somebody else makes, or it's just, you just don't do that. You know, it's like, and I feel like that it's kind of a generational thing. And, you know, especially in the business of film, if you're not being transparent about what you're making, if everybody's not, then the people that are paying us can kind of get away with murder and have, you know, there are predatory distributors out there that operated for decades pretty much unchecked. And then, you know, they're starting to have more trouble in these last couple of years because more and more filmmakers are speaking out, are being transparent and, you know, open about what they're making or what their contract said or, you know, whatever. And I think that's essential for, you know, indie filmmakers to move forward. You have to have a realistic expectation of, you know, what's out there.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because there's this perception, especially among movie fans. You know, a friend of mine on Twitter who does, like, he's a storyboard artist. You know, he works on, you know, like, major films. Like, he's done storyboards for, you know, like, Marvel projects and Star Wars projects and stuff like that, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and somebody called him, somebody referred to him as Hollywood Elite the other day.
Like on social media.
Yeah.
I understand. I it's so funny. Like, I'll have once or twice a month, I'll get something like that. And I'm like, what are you talking about, dude? I just made this movie for, you know, less money than most people earn in a month making minimum wage, you know, put it out. You know, I'm definitely not Hollywood Elite.
Yeah. But there's this perception out there that, well, if you've made a movie, then, you know, then that's it. Like, you've made it. You're famous. You're rich. You can, you know, get whatever you want. And I mean, certainly there are directors out there that, you know, that have had great commercial success. But yeah, those are the exceptions that.
Yeah, I think that misconception, you know, it happened and it grew really strong in the 90s. You know, because like the only, every time someone said independent film, you know, they were tying it to Quentin Tarantino or Kevin Smith or Robert Rodriguez or Spike Lee, you know, all of these guys who did first movies and blew up, you know, and people are like, oh, that's how independent cinema goes. But it's not. Those guys were, even then, and I'm not saying they're not talented, they're super freaking talented, but they were lottery ticket winners. You know, and even back in the 90s, there were, you know, there were thousands of filmmakers under there that we've never heard of. You know what I mean? But they're still making movies. They're still getting them into the marketplace and people just don't hear about them. So when a general public hears the term independent film, we think, you know, Reservoir Dogs was 1.5 million, I think, was the budget, or 1.2 million, something like that. You know, it's independent in the sense that that a studio didn't produce it, you know, although they picked it up and distributed it. But, you know, it's not, you know, there's different levels of independent film, you know, and I think the general public's kind of, they just don't even realize that this whole like sub independent film world even exists.
Yeah, it's true, because you see this, I see this all the time with people. So I have a lot of interests, and you know, one of them is space and astronomy and stuff like that. So I'm in you know, all these different Facebook groups, and at some point the found footage movie Apollo 18 got kind of passed around in that group, and it was just full of all of these, you know, like NASA nerds and science nerds, like complaining that quote Hollywood you know, doesn't understand space. And I'm like, Hollywood didn't have anything to do with that movie. That movie was made in Canada.
Right.
But you know, it's just, you can't shake that perception, and I feel like Amazon has kind of brought some of these movies sometimes to the forefront, because now, you know, this small, you know, sort of self-released you know, micro budget film is sitting right alongside, you know, their big acquisition.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Amazon like busted open independent film distribution in a really big way, you know, and there, you know, there's a downside to it too, but, you know, we'll talk about the positive first, you know, and yeah, it opened it up to where you could make a movie for nothing on your own, upload it to Amazon on your own, nobody's permission, and your movie is right next to Fast and the Furious, you know, or whatever's out that week. You know, it's awesome. And you can get you know, if you know how to, if you know how to market and drive a little bit of traffic, you can get an exponential number of eyes on those film, on those movies, like tons, you know, you just got to kind of get the ball rolling.
And I guess they have, you know, sort of toyed with, you know, the, how they pay out, you know, for views and minutes viewed and things like that over the years. As I guess they've tried to kind of strike a balance between, you know, building up a library of content, you know, versus, you know, maybe I guess, you know, keeping their profit margin, you know, where they want it to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I guess that's kind of the downside from the filmmaker's perspective now is, yeah, those rates are, they're nothing close to what they used to be. You know, 3 years ago, I think it was when they did the first drop, and, you know, they were paying out, I think it was 15 cents an hour, you know, per title, just flat 15 cents an hour. And they used to have a cap, like, so you could only make like a maximum of $75,000 on a project in a year, something like that. And then they removed the cap and they dropped the rate to like, I think it was 10 cents an hour. And, you know, they did that for a little while. And then they started this like scale rate where based on this customer engagement ranking is what they call it. They would decide what they were going to pay you. And that was somewhere between, I think it was 5 and 12 cents an hour. And then I guess it has been a year now. A year ago, they changed it once again to where if on that sliding scale is kind of the same if you're 50% or over on your CER, but if you're under 50%, it's automatic 1 cent an hour. So 50% of all titles that are uploaded through Prime Video Direct are going to be making 1 cent an hour, you know, and that's pretty low.
Yeah.
Just to put it into context, I had a Bigfoot documentary that was streaming like 2 to 3 million minutes a week. You know, and so in a month, it made, you know, and then at the end of the month, I get the CER report. The CER is 47 or 48%. It's like 3% under the line. So it's making 1 cent an hour. And I think it made somewhere around $2,000, you know, for that month. Mm-hmm. Now, if that same title, same amount of minutes was, you know, 3 years prior, that would have been, you know, like $20,000. Or 16, whatever. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. But yeah, so that the rates definitely are lower, but Amazon's not the only platform out there, you know, and it's still, you know, if you have a small movie like mine and it's streaming that many minutes and it's totally possible, you can still make a couple of grand a month off Amazon. You just don't make Amazon your sole source of revenue. You know, you have to be able to get onto other platforms.
Are there other platforms you can that will also like work directly with indie filmmakers, or do the rest of them kind of force you to go through an aggregator or a distributor?
Yeah, that's the catch 22. As Amazon, as far as I know, to my knowledge, they're the only major streamer that allows direct uploads. That's it. Like you definitely won't do it at Hulu. You definitely can't do it at Tubi. You definitely can't do it at Netflix. So yeah, pretty much everywhere else, it's like aggregation or a distributor. There are like, I've talked to maybe half a dozen filmmakers that like have direct relationships with some of these other streamers, but most of them have libraries that are bigger than mine, you know, and I think I have something like 30 titles in my library, and Tubi won't talk to me. So.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And so I guess the other sort of practical thing is, you know, even when you do get a distribution deal and maybe the distributor, you know, maybe they do end up getting some kind of like Netflix exclusive or Shudder exclusive deal, you know, some sort of hybrid deal, like with, you know, with or they put something on Amazon, you know, there could be months, you know, of delay between, you know, when revenue comes in and then they, you know, aggregate it with other things and then they do the accounting on their end. And then at some point, you know, like 9 months later, maybe you get a check back. You know, how does that delay in that process compare with, you know, working with Amazon directly?
Well, when you're working with Amazon directly, once your movie is live, you're paid every 30 days. There's a 90-day delay for the first time. So like when you first upload a movie, you're not going to get paid on that for 3 months. You know, there are 3 months and a, you know, a couple of weeks, whatever it is. And then after that, you're paid every month. So like Amazon is the, like, if you're really like I have to get some money for this right now, it's pretty much the quickest way in. But the problem with that is, like, say you do Amazon on your own, you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot on some of those other platforms. Because like, so say you do Amazon on your own, there's very few distributors that will take fractured rights like that, where if you keep Amazon and they'll distribute to other places, most regular distributors won't do that. You could go to an aggregator, but then you're paying up front, you know, whatever it is, you know, $1,000 a platform or whatever. And a lot of these movies honestly don't make that much. So like, you know, you're not gonna, and you know, you got to decide what, you know, what platform to invest in and all that. And maybe you make the wrong choice. And then, it just, you know, just doesn't work out great. And then there's, you know, distributors like, you know, like Indie Rights, where, you know, they're a little bit smaller. They charge no marketing fees. They take 20% on the back end and they do all that placement for you. And honestly, the 20% that you're losing from Amazon, you're going to make up on those other platforms. And I would say the same thing for a market like Film Hub, which is does the same thing as Indie Rights. They take the 20%, but they're not really a distributor. They call themselves a marketplace. Basically, you upload your movie there to them for free, and then they submit it to all these other platforms. Now, there are a lot of people who say, well, okay, well, I'll do Amazon myself, then I'll give to Film Hub for the rest of these platforms. The problem with that is the way Film Hub's algorithm works is they decide where to place you, you know, based on how you're doing on the first platforms they put you on. And guess what? Amazon's the major platform that they, you know, pull those metrics from. So if you're doing Amazon yourself, they don't have those metrics. And chances are you're not going to get on the larger platforms from that, you know? So again, to me, it's worth giving up that 20% for the, you know, the other platforms.
Interesting. Do you have any sense for, you know, how many eyeballs you can get through, you can reach through Amazon, you know, as compared to, something like Tubi?
So the way it works is there's exponentially more people watching movies on Amazon right now. You know, that's just the way it is. Tubi is growing and it's growing really fast, but it's still fairly niche. You know, like Amazon has, I forget how many people in the US watch it. It's like something like 96 million or something like that. So you'll get more eyeballs on Amazon, but you'll make more money on Tubi, you know, because it's a AVOD, advertising video on demand. So they're not paying per view. They're paying depending on how many commercials are watched on your video and what types of commercials those are and whether or not the people click on the commercials. It's like YouTube in that way.
You okay.
Know? And I don't know what, you know, they don't release those metrics. So like, you don't know what your CPM is or what your RPM is or any of that. All I know, you know, and I can tell from various movies is, you know, so like I have 30, I probably have a dozen on Tubi right now, you know, on both Tubi and Amazon. And I would say probably 70% of the time, the titles make more on Tubi. There are exceptions, but for the most part, I would say Tubi is paying independent filmmakers better.
Interesting. And yeah, and I have noticed that, you know, Tubi's catalog has grown significantly over the past year. I think it's probably ever since they were acquired.
Yeah. When Fox got them too. And now, like, I, you know, I'm not a big football guy, but if you're watching a game, like, you'll see banners, you know, like Tubi banners, you know, it's definitely picked up exponentially. And I talked to a distributor, probably 3 or 4 months ago, I can't name them, but they were saying that their Tubi revenue was eclipsing their Amazon revenue this year for the first time, but it's like tripling it, you know?
Wow. Yeah.
And the only, and again, it's so like Tubi's great. Okay, everybody get on Tubi. But you know, the thing is Amazon, Tubi, like all these things are kind of ephemeral. You know, like, you know, Amazon has changed their rate how many times in the last, you know, 3 years, at least 4 times. Tubi hasn't done it yet to my knowledge, but now that they're acquired by Fox, are they going to continue to keep picking up indie stuff? Is that going to be a forever thing? Or are they going to turn into like a Hulu where they're making their own content, or Netflix? Like, if you remember when Netflix first got into streaming, like they were still picking up indie content, like right and left. Like I know a lot of filmmakers that were licensing movies to Netflix. And these days, like they pick up almost nothing independently.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's, you know, it's all about the originals.
Yeah. And at any time, you know, at any time, and I kind of, I mean, honestly, I expect Amazon will, they'll shut down, or they'll make the barrier to entry much more difficult with the Prime Video Direct, I would guess within the next year, you know, and that's a guess. I, you know, I could be wrong, but I think so.
Yeah.
And Tubi, who knows, you know, it could be totally gone for independent film next year, or it could go on for 20, but what I'm saying, the point is that, you know, you can't count on any one of these platforms. You know, I think the secret to longevity in filmmaking and independent filmmaking, or any filmmaking, is, you know, it's being able to diversify where your content is being exhibited, how you make money on that content, you know, what kind of side things can you monetize, you know. And I think that's pretty much the future of independent film. You know, it's not going to be, you know, a filmmaker making, you know, bootstrapping up a movie, that movie getting discovered, and then just, you know, riding off into the sunset. That shit just doesn't happen. You know, I mean, very, 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 very rare. You know, most right. of us, you know, we have to figure out how to, you know, hustle a living to be an independent filmmaker.
Yeah, and it is a hustle. I think one of your, you know, like one of your YouTube videos, or a couple of them, you actually talked about like your tips for, you know, how to help, how producers of independent films can monetize their movies. And it really was a hustle. I mean,
I mean, every single movie I make, pretty much every single movie I make, I mean, you know, I have a system, but that system constantly changes. But so right now, as soon as I finish a movie, you know, I'm finishing the edit, and I do some of this as I'm going, but yeah, I'll pull 20 to 30, like 30 to 45 second clips from the movie, to post on social media. Cause like the first 90 days of a film's release is like crucial on streaming, because everything's algorithmic. And it's, you know what, I'm going to backtrack this a little bit. One of the best educations a filmmaker can get about marketing a feature film, go start watching YouTube gurus talking about growing their channels, and legit gurus, like people with over 100,000 subscribers. And I learned when I started my YouTube channel and started watching some of those things, man, I learned so much about marketing, and a lot of it is applicable. You know, it's crazy, but yeah, I would highly recommend, Brian G. Johnson, Catherine Manning, Roberto Blake. They're great. And I still watch their stuff.
Yeah, that's cool. And I have some friends that are YouTubers, that have, you know, like big channels, and, you know, and I've heard about, you know, about what, you know, what they, the things that they tried to do, you know, to sort of stay relevant. And, you know, they admitted that they also got a few lucky breaks, where some media outlet picked up like their first video and wrote an article about it. And so they sort of immediately like got to work on a second video and then sent it like early to that reporter. And they kind of just kept doing that. Like every time somebody wrote about them or said something about them, they reached out and they said, well, we, you know, how about, you know, will you do another post if we give you like advanced access to, you know, to the next thing? And, you know, and now they've got, you know, like, I don't know, like 8 million subscribers or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I know several that have blown up like that. And it's, you know, it's the thing about YouTube too, is there'll be a lot of filmmakers that'll get lucky on a video, like, you know, like say they'll have a YouTube and, you know, they upload a couple of things a month and they're not really serious about it. And like out of nowhere, they'll upload this trailer or this short film, or, you know, I know a couple of filmmakers that have uploaded their features and that'll kind of blow up that one, you know, and they'll get monetized off that one. But like, you know, a year later, once that, you know, fever has kind of died down off that project, like the audience doesn't respond to anything else. Like YouTube's a really unique beast. Like, and I know there are exceptions, but I think for the most part, like you have to put out like consistent content, and it has to be a certain type of content. You know, you have to fit into a certain, you know, I overuse the word niche a lot, but you know, it has to fit into a niche. You know, like, and my YouTube channel, for example, I've had a YouTube channel for almost 10 years, but I, you know, I just kind of every once in a while I would upload a trailer or something. I wasn't serious about it. Then a year ago, I decided I'm going to start doing some of these filmmaking tutorials, just kind of just for fun, you know, cause I was like, I've done a lot of movies. I want to share some knowledge. So I started doing it and I started getting really good response for it, but nothing went viral. You know, like, you know, I would, you know, I'd get like, you know, tops like 100-150 views a day, you know, something like that, which isn't horrible, but it's not viral. I mean, as far as like, you know, videos that I've been making since I'm doing it serious, I think my top video right now has like 10,000 views, maybe, you know, so nothing's went viral, but it grows like steadily. So like when I first started taking it serious, you know, I would get like, I don't know, somewhere between 20 and 30 subscribers a month. A couple of months later, that was up to 100. A couple of months later, it was 150, then 200. I think I'm close to 300 subscribers a month now, you know, and it just slowly, and, you know, and I'm not looking to get rich off YouTube, but if I keep doing it, you know, and that, you know, it multiplies and, you know, it gets easier as you go on. And, you know, so, and you know, I was monetized, I don't know, 3 months ago. And, you know, I make a couple $100 a month off of it. And I have 2,200 subscribers, you know, but I also have a really, my RPM and CPMs are really high, you know, and I think that's because my content is so specific and I don't deviate from it. It's really easy for advertisers to advertise on my channel.
Yeah, they sort of know what they're getting. You have a consistent audience, and your audience is engaged in what you're doing because of the nature of it.
Yeah, yeah. Even though it's small, like, yeah, I have a very engaged audience. Like, you know, I have, there's probably 300 or 400 of my subscribers that watch every video. Yeah.
Yeah. And so speaking of YouTube, I'm curious, you know, we're talking about, you know, places you can directly upload a movie if you want to. You know, why hasn't YouTube, you know, sort of taken off like Amazon has with indie filmmakers?
So, okay. So I'll answer this in two ways. First thing is, I think eventually it will. I think it's starting to. But I'll answer this with an example, and it's a TV show example. But you remember a few years ago when they were doing original content and they were pushing it really hard, and you had Cobra Kai, right?
Right.
And how many people knew about Cobra Kai when it was on YouTube? Hardly fucking anybody. And then it hit Netflix and blew up. You know what I mean? I think the platform where you decide to exhibit your thing is really important. And why do people go to YouTube? People aren't, for the most part, in general, and I'm making a really raw generalization here, but people for the most part do not go to YouTube to watch feature length content. They go to watch short videos. They go to watch live streams. Like they're not, if they're going to go watch a movie, they're going to go to Amazon. They're going to go to Netflix. They're going to go to Hulu. That's a branding thing. Yes. And I think that may change. And there are some filmmakers, like I just did an interview with a guy that runs 922 Films, Dan Lotz. And he's uploaded two features directly onto YouTube. But he makes it like an event, you know, like he really involves the audience in these. So like even like he's doing like right now, like, you know, so he's trying to shoot 12 features in 2021. And he takes the audience through the entire process. Like, he's there talking about the ideas. He's talking about the writing of it. He's taking suggestions from his audience. He's getting them engaged. And then when the movies come out, they get, you know, thousands and thousands of views. And then, and speaking of getting lucky, there was a YouTuber, a big YouTuber, Austin McConnell. I think he has like 1 million subscribers, and he saw a trailer for Dan's movie, liked the trailer a ton, and interviewed him on his channel. And Dan, like, his subscriber count like jumped up like 2,000 or 3,000, like basically overnight. You know, and it really kind of jumps. And then I think it was at that point where he was like, oh, wait a minute, maybe this is viable. I could do this. But, you know, they're, you know, we'll see. I think on YouTube right now, if you go like the route that Dan is and you do all this supplemental material and you really involve the audience, I think you can use it. But I think as far as just like uploading it and trying to bring people to it, I mean, you might get eyeballs, but it'll be really hard to monetize and make money off of it right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other success stories I've heard are like, you've got guys like David F. Sandberg, who kind of got famous releasing his horror shorts on YouTube. And one of those got turned into a feature with Lights Out.
Yeah. Yeah.
That does make sense because YouTube itself is kind of a culture, and it's a different culture and position differently.
It's still, you know, first and foremost, it's still a search engine and a social media platform. You know, it is a social media platform. It's just video based, you know, so it's all interactive, you know, whereas, you know, Amazon or a Hulu, those are all, you know, passive audience experiences. YouTube is a, you know, it's a back and forth. Yeah. And so if you're good at that back and forth, like, you could do very well on YouTube, yeah, even just with your features. But if you're not, you won't in general.
So it's sort of like the saying that if all you have is a hammer, then everything's a nail. These things are all different tools, maybe in your tool bag as a producer. You have to know how to use them properly to get the most bang for your buck.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, like, so I've said, you know, like, I don't upload full features directly on YouTube right now, but that doesn't mean I'm against it or that I'm not laying the groundwork to do that. You know, so I have a secondary YouTube channel that's just for my documentaries, and I basically just upload documentary clips right now. So it's not super interactive, and it shows in the subscriber count. You know, the channel's almost 1 year old. I think I have, if I have 100 subscribers, I'll be surprised. But my plan is to start being more interactive with that, to grow that, to eventually be able to monetize that and put, if not the full features, chunks of them. Like, I know a filmmaker named, what's his name? Al Profit. He's a documentary filmmaker. I think he's from Detroit. He makes a lot of true crime stuff. And his YouTube's huge. I forget how many subscribers he has, like 400,000 or 500,000. But he makes these feature length documentaries, and then he takes chunks of those, like 5 or 10 minute chunks, and puts those on his YouTube as little standalone things, and then just gets views on them. So then people either watch that 5 minutes and then go watch the feature, or they just watch the short content on YouTube, and then eventually it's monetized. You know, so I've been experimenting with that. I haven't had as much luck, but my stuff is a little more broad, especially in documentaries. I'm doing all these different subjects. So it'd almost be, if I was trying to do that, I would need like a YouTube channel for, you know, each like subcategory of documentary that I was doing, which I'm, you know, there's not enough hours in the day to try that.
Right, right. And it seems like, just sort of looking at your history, you know, on that note, you've kind of shifted over in more recent years from, you know, from narrative features and genre features to documentaries.
Yeah, I've done that really hard in about the last year and a half. And I honestly just, I started it, it was like summer last year, because a producer had said, I had trouble on my last couple of narratives, you know, as far as making money, they weren't doing that well. And I was kind of at a loss, because like this whole business model that I had built just wasn't really working anymore with them. And I was thinking about doing another feature, and I was like, man, if I put $50,000 or raise $50,000 for this movie, I don't know how I'm going to make it back. And a producer friend of mine said, hey, you should try documentaries. And at the time I had absolutely zero interest in documentaries as a filmmaker. You know, I'll watch them, but I didn't want to make them. But, it kind of stuck in my head. A few months later, I was like, I was talking to a friend. She owns a dog rescue in Las Vegas. And I was like, that would be a cool, I'm a big dog lover. So I was like, that'd be a cool little like positive documentary. I'll go down there for a couple of days, shoot interviews with her and her staff, shoot the dogs. Like, it'll be fun. And, you know, so like I stayed out there with her and stayed a couple of days, shot that thing. Like, I literally slapped it together in post in like, I don't know, like five, six days, real short, and then just put it up. And it was so easy. And like from the first day of shooting to finishing, it was like less than 2 weeks. So I was like, man, I could do a few of these. And I had no idea what was going to perform or not. So I was like, what else could I do really quick? I'll do one on filmmaking. So I did Micro Budget Marauders. I interviewed myself and like five other like friends, you know, and then, I forget what the next one was. Anxiety documentary. I suffer from clinical anxiety. So I interviewed a couple of friends and myself and did that one. And then I did six documentaries in a real short period of time and put them all up. And then, you know, start looking at the returns. And, you know, some of them did nothing. You know, Micro Budget Marauders, that made nothing. I think I made 25 cents on that. And, but the dog rescue, like, it was making just under $1,000 a month. Now, that's not huge numbers, but if you're thinking, hey, I spent 2 weeks on this and you can make $1,000 a month on it, even if it was only 3 months, you're into profit, you know? So that, and then I had a few others like do like 500 or 400. And I was like, but if I had enough of these, like, cause I made six of them in like less than 2 months. So I was like, if I just take a year off, stop making narratives, just like do this, just go full steam ahead, make like 20 of these motherfuckers. Like, even if they're only making $300 or $400 a piece collectively, that's going to be a significant amount of money, you know? So I just start doing it. And then as I'm going, I start seeing what documentaries are doing better, which documentaries are doing worse, you know, start, you know, being a little more selective about the material I'm doing, you know, where, you know, like, you know, 7 months ago, I was doing three a month. Now I only do one a month, you know, because I'm a little more savvy as far as picking the material. And then the other thing that I realized about 2 months in is as far as marketing goes, and finding your audience, because I was starting to look at the YouTube thing, and I'm like, they're talking all about niching down and finding your audience and where to find your audience. And documentaries, as opposed to narrative films, it's really easy to find that target audience. You know, you do a movie about dog rescues, who's your target audience?
Yeah,
people that love animals. You know, right there you have a broad one. Then you have people that are into dog rescues. You can target people that are specific to that area that specific dog rescue is in, you know. That's like, oh man. And then maybe I think 4 months in, I discovered Bigfoot as a filmmaker. You know, I'm not a believer, but I find the people fascinating. And you know, so I did this documentary on Bigfoot, and that was the one that did the like 2 million a week. I was like, holy shit. So, you know, then we did an alien one, did, you know, an astrology one, you know, one on a guy that was contacted by aliens. That one did really well. And it just kind of went from there. And honestly, you know, and I haven't given up on narrative features. You know, I don't want people to get me wrong. Like, and I still think a lot of the stuff that I talk about on my channel, you know, even though I'm talking a lot about the documentaries, because that's what I've been doing for the last year and a half, but it can apply to narratives, you know? So like, I definitely, my plan was actually to shoot two narrative films. I was going to do it this month, but I rarely do out of state shoots for documentaries, but I did one in Vegas about 4 weeks ago, and it just spooked me. You know, like the travel, being in public a little bit more. And a friend of mine was shooting a narrative in Ohio, and somebody there got COVID, and you know, they were talking about, you know, legal things with the production, and it just kind of spooked me. So until COVID is like under control, I can't see doing another narrative. Like I'll keep doing documentaries until then. I mean, I'm not going to stop doing documentaries, but I will like take pauses to do narratives now. Like, you know, the plan is once or twice a year.
Okay. Yeah. That's fascinating. And yeah, I mean, you can really see the shift in your filmography. You know, totally. I couldn't imagine, you know, making 3 films a month, but it's true. Cause you had just what I see in, you know, on IMDb in calendar year 2020, there's like 15 titles, you know, which is more than one a month. So.
Yeah, totally. Like at the end of 2019, I think I can't remember how many I did, but it was a few.
Yeah.
So, and I was setting on my computer right now. I think I got like 7 to complete.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. And this is what you do full time now. Is that, this is like your sole source of income?
I mean, I've been a full time filmmaker for about 10 years, but I was a freelance filmmaker for most of that. Like, you know, I was being paid by clients to edit, or, you know, to direct. I was a hired gun director on a lot of features. Eventually one day, you know, cause whenever you're freelance, and I don't care, unless you get up in the upper like echelon of like studio work, it is not stable, you know? And so you might have 6 months, shit, you might have 3 years straight. That's awesome. And then you'll have like 6 months where you don't have anything, you know? And just that whiplash, that back and forth, you know, feast or famine. And the fact that I did so many, like, you know, hired gun directing gigs for these producers, and, you know, I was paid for them, you know, I paid up front, you know, but I didn't have back end on these things. And, you know, none of these movies are, you know, big hits or anything like that, but collectively these movies have made millions of dollars, and I'm not seeing any of that, you know? And I was like, man, right. I want to own stuff. Like I made that decision about a little over 3 years ago. I was like, I don't want to work for people anymore. I want to work for myself. I want to make my own things, and I want to own it. I want to make money on it when I sleep, you know? So that pretty much from that day to here, all my energy has been put in towards achieving that goal. And in the last year and a half, I've achieved it. So I no longer do freelance work. I don't do hired gigs, you know, any of that. Everything I make is either from direct exhibition of the movies. You know, I make a little bit off the YouTube channel, and then, you know, merch and some ancillary products from those movies. And that's it.
That's really cool. And that's a good way to look at it. And that's kind of a good outlook, is, you know, to work for yourself. And I've been in that position. Yeah, I've had jobs. I've had 9-to-5 jobs. I've run my own business. You know, I've done that, and I definitely know that feeling you know, when you're working on your own, and it can be scary. Because if you fail, it's all on you too, very liberating.
Totally. Well, you know, I worked for Fox Digital years ago. I was editing promos and trailers and proofs of concept and stuff like that. And I mean, man, I was making like $1,100 or $1,200 a day. Like I was making a lot of money. I think that's probably the most money that I mean, even now, like, yeah, I'm probably doing close to that now, but probably not. I've never been more miserable in my life. You know, I did that for a little over or under a year, I can't remember. And it was the worst period of my life. And it was all stemmed from that job. It was awful, you know? So like when they say money does it, why happiness, it really does it. You know, like I would rather make a fraction of that, just enough to pay my bills and own it, you know?
Yeah. I totally get that. For sure.
And plus, you know, I'm getting older too. And, you know, who knows if Social Security is going to be here, you know, in 10 years, you know? So right. I want a library of things that are making money for me in perpetuity. Like I look at it as my retirement.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that totally makes sense. Yeah. So what I wanted to say too is we're kind of seeing this now. You talked about how you don't own, you know, when you do that work for hire, you don't own anything. You have no control over what happens to it. You don't stand to gain or lose anything based on how successful it is.
At their creative whims.
Yeah. And we just saw this with Warner Brothers, right? Where like their 2021 theatrical slate just got committed to a streaming service.
Right.
And you know, we saw guys like Christopher Nolan and Denis Villeneuve, who are, you know, big names. You know, like people, highly respected people. You would think that if WB would have called anyone, you know, prior to making decisions like that, it would have been those guys. And the fact that they're not in the loop means no one was in the loop. And on the one hand, you say, well, that's just business. And that's the way this business works. But it's sort of, you know, eye opening to say, look, you know, these companies, they don't care about you. You know, it's all about the content and the product. It belongs to them, and they're gonna do what they want with it.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, and people like Christopher Nolan, like, he's gonna be just fine. He's got enough money. But if you go down the ladder, like, you know, way down the ladder, that, you know, they're independent filmmakers that like are basically in that same boat. You know, like, they were getting ready to have their first, like, they just did their first movie. And I'm just totally making this up. I'm assuming there's somebody out there like this, just made their first movie for Warner Brothers. You know, it cost $2 or $3 million. It was going to be theatrical, and now it's not, you know?
Right. Right.
And who knows, you know, because the back end on that's not going to be what it was if it would have been theatrical. So who knows what they're going to make? I mean, that person could be back working at Starbucks in a year.
You talk a lot about streaming all the time. I'm really curious about your thoughts on physical media. Like, do you do any kind of physical distribution? You sell, you know, physical distribution rights if that's something you're not interested in yourself. I'm just kind of never heard you talk about that. So.
Yeah, I'm kind of quiet on it. I have nothing against it, and I know some filmmakers that do really well with physical. Since 2014, I personally haven't made much on physical, or in comparison to streaming. And I don't know if that's because, you know, my particular projects lend themselves more to streaming. I would say with documentaries, that's definitely the case. I don't think that there are people out there clamoring for, you know, physical copies of documentaries, like, in the same way that, say, horror movies do.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, little by little, I'm real into the concept of, you know, putting more energy into what's working and less energy into what's not, or into what's shrinking. And people don't want to hear this, but this is just the truth. Physical media is going away. Like, it might not completely do it in our lifetime, but it's going, it every year it diminishes every year. That this year, I'm sorry, I take that back, except for 2020. 2020, there was a slight peak. But you got to remember where it was starting from in 2019. So it's not really significant, you know, and I would rather look towards the future than try to hold on to something that's not. Now, that said, if I was doing, and I also like to do a broad range of stuff. So like, if I was just making horror movies, I would be all over physical media. But I love horror movies, but it's not all I want to make. And like, in this last year, I haven't made one, you know, so, you know, I made documentaries all this year. So I'm doing more streaming than physical.
Yeah, that makes sense. And even when you look at the numbers, like, and every time a new format gets released, I feel like that's actually just another, you know, just another hit. Like, if you look at the pie charts every month for physical media sales, you know, DVD is still, I think it's over 50% usually. And sometimes it's closer to 60% of the pie, compared to Blu-ray and 4K, and 4K is just a tiny, tiny sliver. So you're talking about a format that's two generations behind,
right.
That's 480p. That's less than what you get with streaming. and that's, that's still what most people are buying. It's surprising to, you know, cinephiles to see that, but yeah, I think when you just think by the public at large, I think you're right. They just don't care about it anymore.
Well, and that brings up a good point, because I think that the problem that most filmmakers have when it comes to marketing is they think too much from their own perspective. Like, they think as a filmmaker how they consume media. They don't think about how the audience is. Now, the exception to that rule, like I said, is horror, because like the horror audiences are, you know, they're super into it. So like horror filmmakers, I kind of get that train of thought. But like when you start getting out of that into other ones, they're not thinking about the audience, you know, and you can see that in the way they try to market their movies. Like, you'll see filmmakers, I talk about this on my channel all the time, but filmmakers go into filmmaking groups and like, hey, watch my movie, check my movie out to other filmmakers. You know, I'm like, oh my God, dude. That's such a waste of time and such the wrong audience to be trying to, you know, push your movie on, unless your movie is about filmmaking. It's just not a good place to promote.
Yeah. That makes sense. And really, like, what most the diehards that are left that buy physical copies of everything, you know, they're collectors. And unless you can, you know, really market your piece as some type of collectible, like it's got, you know, it's got attractive packaging and things like that. Like, that's where the effort is. And it's a hustle, you know, just like the streaming is a hustle. It's just in different places.
Exactly. And I'm also, another reason that I don't quite get into physical quite as much is I don't like to travel. Like, I don't want to go to conventions. Like, I'm not a convention guy. I don't like crowds. Like that doesn't work for me. Like, I can online, like, you know, I mentioned anxiety earlier, and like online, I can be outgoing. I can sit here on this podcast and I sound confident and blah, 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 but I'm really not. I have all kinds of social anxiety. Like, when I'm in a public setting, like I have problems selling like that. So that's another reason that I tend not to go that route. Cause if you're going to do physical, you really have to get out there and mix it up. Like, you know, especially going back to the horror filmmakers, like the few guys that I know that are still doing well with physical, they're out there like in person hawking their stuff, you know?
Yep. Yeah. Those are the stories I hear. Guys like Drew Marvick, who made a movie called Pool Party Massacre.
Yep.
You know, and he's just, you know, he's like, I can picture him, you know, driving around from convention to convention with a truck full of Blu-rays.
Yeah. Henrik Kuto, same thing. I mean, that's how he made his career. Now he's pivoting and he's embracing streaming and stuff now, but for years, that's how he did it. And he's a great salesman, super personable. He made his career, as a 17 or 18 year old out there, like hustling his short films at a horror convention. And one of the distributors saw him out there doing it and hired him to come work for them.
Oh,
like,
wow.
That's how he started. I was like, wow. I thought that was really cool. But me, I don't have that same kind of in-person, you know, ability to sell. You know, it's another reason why I don't do live streams a lot. Like, I start getting these like anxiety, like butterfly things, and I have a lot of trouble with it.
You got to stick to what you're good at, and you got to, you know,
exactly.
So speaking of a movie about filmmaking that you mentioned a minute ago. So I watched Monsters in the Woods yesterday.
Oh yeah,
which I'm a big fan. I love movies about movies.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one of my, you know, it's sort of one of my niches that I love. One Cut of the Dead was, it was like my favorite film from the year before last.
I haven't seen that. I'll have to check it out.
Oh, you should check it out. One Cut of the Dead is amazing. It was a Japanese student film.
Huh.
That they spent around like less than $30,000 US.
Okay.
And it went on to make like 30 million in Japanese cinema.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's one of the it's I think got like the title for like the most profitable Japanese film of all time.
Wow.
But yeah, One Cut of the Dead is fantastic. But so I watched Monsters in the Woods, and I I absolutely loved it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I love the creature design and just the look of the film. Like, I like new movies that look like they're old movies.
Yeah, yeah. So I do too. In the case of Monsters in the Woods, though, I'll admit it. The reason that I did that on the, and if you see the original cut of the movie, it's not, it's clean. There's no grindhouse look. And you can see why I did the grindhouse look. that movie, it was a troubled production. I did a video on it on my channel, but, you know, different cameras were used, different sections anyway. And I wasn't quite as good at color correction back in those days. And I couldn't match the shots. Like there's a lot of sequences where it just, the shots just like, they did not match. Like it didn't look right. It looked like two different movies. And so when I got the rights back and was able to like recut, do a director's edition, I decided to do the grindhouse layer over top of it to kind of like cover that up.
Okay. Yeah, but it's still fun.
But I think in the end, I think it was the right choice, and it makes me wonder why I didn't do it in the first place.
Yeah, I think it is for the right for that movie too. I mean, it just sort of enhances the experience of it.
Yeah,
it just kind of gives it that that feel, because it's you know, you're doing a, you know, sort of a new spin on a kind of a classic monster movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I'm trying to remember. Oh yeah. So the story behind it is, so I did a drama, kind of a thriller drama called Trap, about a year, maybe a year and a half before Monsters in the Woods. It was my fourth film. And prior to Trap, I sold everything right out the box. Like just boom, boom, boom. Trap. And the first two were both, horror movies. Trap was the third movie. So then when I got to Trap, it was not a horror movie, and man, nobody would pick it up. Like no distributor wanted it. And I think it's good. I still think it's one of my best movies. But anyway, it wouldn't get picked up. And I was talking to a sales agent who was considering taking it on. And he said, you know, if you just like cut monsters into it or something, we could probably do something with this. And at the time, I was so desperate to get it out that I actually considered it for a couple of days. Like I went so far as to like go back into the script and like, how would I insert this? And I actually like had a plan on how I was going to insert monsters into this movie that had nothing to do with monsters. And then like, I don't know, like that second night, I just like, I had a realization. I was like, all of this work, I might as well just shoot a monster movie, like let this go and just shoot a monster movie. And so I made a movie about a filmmaker who couldn't sell his drama movie and had to go cut monster scenes into it. That was the genesis.
Okay. Yeah. I saw that in the credits, like in the thanks section of the credits. And yeah. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, I thanked the distributors that turned down Trap. Was that what it was?
Yeah, it was something like that.
Yeah, I can't. It's been a while since I looked at it, but yeah, that's totally. And I really, like I said, it was a troubled production, but it wasn't like there wasn't fighting or nothing. It was a positive experience. You know, we had some issues with the original monster designs. Just didn't work out. And you know, we basically had to stop production and then come back a few weeks later with a new effects team, and it just changed the whole structure of the movie. You know, and initially Monsters in the Woods, you know, the three acts, the first act was from the perspective of the behind the scenes crew, so it was all found footage. And then the second act was happening at the same time as the first act, was all the stuff with the angels, and that was shot like where it was supposed to be shot, like a traditional movie, you know, dollies, you know, steady, no handheld. And then at the massacre, it would go back to chaotic and the two stories would come together. So yeah, that sounds cool. But what happened because of the mix up with the monsters, and the whole second act was just shortened, so I basically had to lengthen the found footage stuff, the stuff with the camera crew, all that to make up the runtime. Okay. And it just, so, and I still really like the movie, but like, I feel like structurally it's a little off, like the pace is a little off because of that. But, you know, it, but everything else though was really positive on the shoot. Really fun experience.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And, you know, and sometimes that happens and you just have to,
you have
kind
to
of adjust on the fly, right?
Yeah, you have to roll with it and then figure out. I mean, I've had a few movies where, you know, like things changed in production and I basically had to turn it into a different movie in post. You know, Monsters in the Woods a little bit, but really huge example of that was Edges of Darkness, my zombie movie, zombie computer vampire movie. You know, initially that movie was supposed to be an anthology, three completely different stories told on their own. So you'd have one, then the other, then the other. And about a week before production, the director of the second story left to shoot a feature of her own. So I had to really quickly write a middle story. And then about a week into production, the producer, executive producer comes to me. He's like, yeah, I just heard, and I don't even know where he heard this. Anthologies just aren't doing well right now. So we need to make this a single story. So basically I had to figure out a way pretty much in post how to combine these stories into a single narrative where it kind of all fit together. And I would say I was never quite 100% successful, but it, you know, I'm pretty proud of it for what I had to work with and what I had to turn it into. And then financially, of course, you know, Edges of Darkness probably made more money than anything else that I've, you know, that I've generated on my own.
Yeah.
That's a movie that did really well on physical.
A lot of fans just want that. They want to hold it in their hands.
Yeah, well, and the cool thing, I know I, you know, was just talking a lot of negatives about physical, but the cool thing, the real positive thing about physical is you need to sell much less product to make the money. You know, I mean, right. if you're selling a physical DVD for $12.99 and, you know, your profit margin on it is, you know, $7 or $8, you know, that same rental on, if it's a rental on Amazon, you're going to make 99 cents off of it, you know, if it's renting for $2.99. And then if, you know, and if it's just a subscription streaming, you know, you're making 1 to 12 cents an hour. You know, you'd need like 1,000 views to get up to that, you know, that one rental, that one purchase of physical. So right. There definitely is, like, if you're smart about it, there's definitely a way to make money with physical. But again, to backtrack into, you know, why I don't do physical is, again, the amount of eyeballs on that. Like, if you're talking about, if you're talking about that one movie and return on investment, you know, you might get a little higher ROI, you know, going physical. But as far as like building an audience and looking to the future and getting more eyeballs on your stuff, astronomically more people are going to see it streaming than physical. You know, and you know, it just breaks you out of that small niche. Now, that said, there's no reason not to do both, except that I just don't like to. Sure. And there's a lot of filmmakers that feel the same way about streaming, you know, and then I, you know, shame them. And then now I feel bad.
No, it's, I mean, you have to do what works. And I think that it's there's a great line from I think it was in North Dallas 40.
I love that movie.
Where the guy's like talking to the coach and he says every time I say that this is just a game, you say it's business. And every time I say it's business, you tell me it's just a game.
Right.
And I think
totally. That's independent filmmakers, like in general. Like it's so funny. You know, you do a video, right? And you do a video talking about, you know, marketing or distribution, and you know, you'll get, you know, half a dozen comments on a social media thread like, I thought movies were about the art, dude. You know, stuff like that. But then you'll turn around, you'll do one on like, you know, the art side of it, like the, you know, craft of screenwriting or whatever. And then you get a bunch of people commenting on it, like, it's a business first, man. So you can never win.
Right. Yeah. There's going back to One Cut of the Dead, there's a great line in there that I always quote to people where like the director is like, he's arguing, he's got this like He's got this A-list actor that they've cast, and that he's trying to kind of like manage the egos along with everything else, and it's a low budget production. And it's like a big get for this production to have this you know, this talent on the screen, and of course the actor knows that, so he's really arrogant and he wants to flex his creative muscles and stuff, and so he's fighting with the director the whole time, and the director just at one point just pulls him aside and looks him in the eye and says, "It's a TV show before it's art."
Right. Yeah.
And I kind of like that because, yeah, like until you without financing, you can't buy cameras and you can't, you know, pay makeup people and you can't, you know, buy supplies. You know, and without distribution, no one's ever going to see it. So, you know, you have to sort of balance both sides.
Yeah, I mean, here, like, this is my little spiel on the whole, like, you know, artist versus like business thing is, you know, I was the struggling, broke artist for, you know, probably 15 years, first 15 years of my career, first 10 years, sorry, anyway. And, you know, and you hit a certain point, you get a little bit older, and, you know, you know, it's just being a starving artist is just not very, just like in Monsters of the Woods, it sucks when you're in your, you know, mid 30s to 40, and then it's just not cool anymore. You know, like you need to make more money. And some people say, well, get a day job and do movies part time. I got no interest in that. I want to make movies, you know, so I'm going to make movies. And in order to do that, you have to tackle the business with every bit as much, you know, energy and passion as you do the art. And if you don't, maybe you'll get lucky, but most likely you won't. And honestly, guys, there's so much content out there now. People talk a lot about oversaturation, you know, standing above. If you don't know how to market, I don't give it, your movie could be excellent and it'll still get buried. Like I've been given movies to a few movies to indie rights distributor, and you know I look at other filmmakers with movies in there, and there's some of them that, I mean, you know, they get a bad rep sometimes for some lower quality projects, but there's some of those movies that are excellent, like movies like budgeted well under 100 grand, but they look fantastic, like competitive with studio level stuff, and they're great. And you watch the movie and you're like, man, this is awesome. I bet you it's making a ton. They're making like $50 a month, you know. and then you're like, how? And you look the filmmaker up, you go over their social media and how they're marketing or not marketing, and you realize this is why. It's not enough to make a good movie anymore. It's not. You could make an excellent movie and it could and put it out on Amazon and all that. It's out there, but nobody's ever going to discover it because you don't know how to push them to it, because there's too much other crap out there. You have to learn the marketing. Like, being an independent filmmaker, unless you're independently wealthy or you get extremely lucky on an initial project and it just blows up, goes viral, whatever, you have to learn the marketing. And if you don't, or find somebody who does and partner with them. And if not, chances are you'll get two or three movies in and you'll give up or sooner.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think we're going to leave it there, man. I was going to ask you sort of what your advice for independent filmmakers today, but I think we've got it. You know, you guys have been listening to Jay Horton. He's a movie making machine. I assume that he's just made three more features in the hour that we've been talking.
Yeah, when I took that pause, I was just exporting the last one.
You know, go and check him out. I'm gonna put a link. I was gonna put a link to your website in the show notes, but is that is there sort of like one sort of like general place where you kind of send people to kind of, you know, get to know more about you and your projects?
I mean, really right now, I mostly try to push people towards the YouTube channel far as that. My website is, I don't use it a lot, but I probably should more, but you know.
All right.
But yeah, mostly my YouTube, which is just, you know, youtube.com/JHorton.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So check out Jay Horton's YouTube page, and we'll put links there as always. Jason, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time, man.
Oh, no problem, Patrick. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Take care.